something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And Julie, you know what's been in the news recently?
Wieners, wiener.
Well, yeah, yeah, but below the headlines.
Okay, yes. Very important technological advances about drones.
Yes, tiny robots.
Tiny robots. Will.
Tiny robots. They could be the proverbial fly on the wall, on the proverbial wall, in the room where...
Of Wieners' room.
Of Wieners' room, yeah.
Right. But we wouldn't necessarily want that.
Right.
I think that we have enough media streaming about him. We don't necessarily need a micro drone hanging out in his bedroom.
Exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's the New York Times had a great article called War Evolves with Drones, Some Tiny as Bugs. And, also the larger, more conventional drones, were recently in the news. They were the ones that gathered intelligence on Osama bin Laden's Pakistani hideaway, using one of the new stealth drones. So this is a technology that is getting a lot of traction these days, and it's pretty important. And the micro drone thing is incredibly cool and definitely feeds into my paranoia about privacy.
And your paranoia is that tiny robots are listening to every word you say and watching you change clothes or something?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah. Perv tiny robots outside my window wearing little trench coats.
Well, it's interesting. Talking about paranoia, because Iran, the government of Iran has shown some paranoia that, and I'm not saying it's bad paranoia, because that there've been a couple of stories in the last few years. In 2008, mm-hmm. they arrested two pigeons that were suspected of spying near a uranium enrichment facility. And in 2007, 14 squirrels were supposedly captured that were armed with state-of-the-art espionage equipment.
Right.
Which these sound ridiculous, arresting squirrels and pigeons. But the charge was here that these were animals that had been geared up with some sort of espionage equipment and were being used by an outside force, probably the United States, to see what they were doing.
Right.
So... But imagine that paranoia taken a step farther to where the paranoia is that the squirrels may not actually be squirrels. They may be robots. The birds may be robots spying on us. The bugs may actually be robots spying on our every move. And certainly if you're a country like Iran, mm-hmm. This could be a very well possibility in the near future.
Well, and also think of the context too. I mean, with Stuxnet in Iran, which we know is the computer virus that was developed to essentially like bring down their nuclear capacity.
Yeah,
right?
Shut down the system. Yeah.
So you can understand why they might take a look around a park and start to get a little bit paranoid about the nearest chipmunk.
Right. Especially since this is where the technology has been headed, mm-hmm. and where it's continuing to head with some real impressive speed.
Yeah. And when we talk about a drone, and particularly a micro drone, let's talk about what this is. This is essentially a super fancy remote controlled plane.
Yes.
And it's an unmanned aerial vehicle.
Yes. Generally with some degree of autonomy.
Yes.
There's an important distinction. Like the most famous examples are the Predator and mm-hmm. and the Reaper, which have been just two standout aerial drones for the U.S. military. And we have an article on both of these on the HowStuffWorks website. So if you go to the HowStuffWorks, go to the search bar, put in Predator or put in a Reaper, and you'll get a really nice article.
It'll tell you everything under the hood. It's very cool.
Because we're not going to really go under the hood with these in this podcast, but they are really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Just the technology, not any judgments on how they're used, but it's really interesting technology. So, it basically comes down to all of these things are what we call an in-the-loop system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're not really robots out there. You're not creating a machine and saying, "Hey, go out and kill, go out and do this job,"
right?
And then come back and tell me how it went. On the other hand, it's not a guy sitting there, and controlling it the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It's
programmed to a certain degree.
Yeah, it's essentially someone is at the controls to dictate the application of lethal force,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's kind of a hybrid between autonomy and remote control, and that's basically the state of these UAVs, these unmanned aerial vehicles
mm-hmm.
that are out there, really in most of the skies over military zones that the U.S. is engaged in.
That's right, and there are two different types. There's a surveillance drones, right? And there are combat drones,
right.
With missiles.
Yeah,
and
surveillance like the it would be like a predator just seeing what the lay of the land is.
Right.
Or in this case, what we were talking with Osama bin Laden, used to tell where a target is, and then the means of reaching that target may actually just be troops
or a special forces team. It's very unusual that they will use a combat drone to take out like a compound like Osama bin Laden's, which they did not, but from time to time they've taken out Al-Qaeda members if they were, say, driving in a car, across the highway or whatever. They would use one of these drones to blow up the car.
Right.
But again, this is unusual. It's more likely used for surveillance. But obviously, if it's a combat drone and it's got missiles, then there's a higher level of engagement with the person who's controlling it. So this is from a Wired article. Or rather, this is from their Danger Room, their blog. It says, unmanned aerial vehicles are a huge growth industry for the U.S. and its closest allies, and the source of one of America's greatest military advantages. Starting in the mid-1990s, the unarmed Predator drone helped the U.S. build an unprecedented, persistent surveillance system capable of spotting targets around the clock. Later armed with missiles, the Predator became an aerial sniper, picking off hundreds of insurgents in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan every year. So the Pentagon has scores of communication satellites for linking drones and ground troops and imagery analysts.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pentagon now has some 7,000 aerial drones compared with fewer than 50 just a decade ago.
Wow.
So as you can see, this is a really important part of how the U.S. is sort of trying to figure out this war on terror, as they're calling it, mm-hmm. and just general security around the world.
Yeah, I mean, the advantages here are huge. Just to run through a few of them here. I mean, most obviously, you replace putting a soldier into a dangerous situation.
Yes.
And that's why there's a lot of effort towards creating land-based drone technology, too.
Yeah.
And there have been a number of these have been tested, but nothing is really the standard. It hasn't been standardized in the same way that these UAVs are ruling the skies now. But another important thing, it reduces civilian casualties if used properly,
mm-hmm.
and if you have sufficient ethical programming developed, which mm-hmm. that's kind of like looking forward, not so much now. It also acts as looking forward too, it could act as a force multiplier where, we talked about this in the loop situation,
yeah.
A man in the loop where there's a guy controlling it. You know, and he's going to jump in and, you know, do the fine tuning or the application of lethal force. But they're talking about eventually moving it towards a man on the loop, where you'd basically have like one guy manning a team of robots.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be these, like, you know, maybe six different UAVs, mostly doing their own thing, mm-hmm. with one guy supervising and, you know, jumping in to micromanage as need be. But that would be a force multiplier, because then you have one, basically have one combat pilot, in like six places at once.
Right.
Yeah,
which is huge. Yeah.
So, and then there are a number of other advantages that break down to the use of robots in warfare, which is, you don't have anger, revenge, hunger, fear, thrown in there with to modify what's going mm-hmm. on in the battlefield. And it's just, and they can also generally make faster decisions than humans, though that decision making process, of course, is something that requires a great deal of discussion.
Yeah, there's been a lot of questions ethically around that,
yeah.
right? So, because there's this growing disconnect between the American public and its wars. And
right.
the drone, again, the advantage is that you're not putting anybody in harm's way, at least on the American front, right?
Right.
But there is, again, that distance between what is, you know, what we're actually doing to someone else and, you know, the decision-making process. So the farther the distance is, the easier it is to sort of make that decision, right?
Right. It comes back to the thing where it just makes waging war potentially mm-hmm. easier and killing potentially easier. Because, I mean, on one hand, like, what's the huge, like what's the worst thing that an army, a government engaged in military activity wants to see? And that is, images of coffins coming home with dead servicemen and mm-hmm. women in it. You know, that's like, you know, PR nightmare thing
right.
to be avoided. We've seen it, you know, banned in the past. But if you remove that, where suddenly there's like no risk to servicemen and women, you know,
mm-hmm.
suddenly there are minimal risk. Like it becomes a situation where the fear of one's own death or the fear of death of ones one cares about or just mm-hmm. seeing the carnage, you're not going to see the carnage on your own side because of all these robots.
No, but of course the problem is that, and we've seen this mm-hmm. time and again, Afghanistan, where you have civilian casualties.
Yeah.
And, the reason is that when you've got this sort of technology, it's essentially painting a target. They call
right.
it painting a target. With a laser, there's a host of variables that the computer has to calibrate the system for. So that includes wind speed, direction, and other battlefield variables. So something can go wrong. It's very possible in any technology, there's going to be a margin of error and
right.
deaths are going to happen.
Well, even if it works perfectly, if you're using a basically a robotic army against a human insurgents,
yes.
humans are going to die on one side and robots will occasionally crash on the other. And it's there's a large inequity there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, the main problem here is this question of autonomy mm-hmm. as we go forward with this technology, because it will become more and more autonomous. Right.
Right.
This is the idea. I mean, you know, typically technology doesn't go backward. Right. So if we create a system that is more enhanced, that can make more decisions, than the margin of error could possibly go up. And we've talked with Dr. Arkin from Georgia Tech before, who is a robotics ethicist and, mm-hmm. and deals with warfare and robots quite a bit. And he was talking about programming robots with, the Geneva Protocol, right?
Yeah. Having this ethical governor in the
yeah.
robot that
yeah.
would dictate how it's going to carry out its military actions.
Right. Which makes sense. I mean, this is a good step forward, right? Because if you can program that, if you can give the algorithm for, you know, an if and then you can avoid some of the pitfalls. The problem is that people will point out is that robots do not have a nuanced ability to deal with emotions. And
right.
we know that emotions, for better or worse, can guide our judgment.
Right.
So you know, on the one hand, you've got the passion of war is reduced with these, autonomous machines, but on the other hand, you know, there's this the empathy and so on and so forth that sort of makes us human and makes us create exceptions is not there.
Yeah, and I mean, modern warfare especially is such a chaotic situation, and there are enough obstacles in just creating a robot that can navigate the human kitchen.
Yeah,
you know, so it's the idea of creating a robot that could seamlessly navigate the environment of war, an environment mm-hmm. that humans cannot even navigate
right.
without catastrophe, is quite a hurdle to overcome.
Yeah. And so, but you know, well, here we've got these micro drones, which at this point, they're not lethal, right? They're just surveilling.
Right.
So to talk a little bit more about the micro drones and less about, drones like the Predator, just kind of consider this stat. Again, this is from Wired. This is, since September 11th, the hours the Air Force devotes to flying missions for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance have gone up 3,100%, most of that from increased operations of drones. Every day, the Air Force must process almost 1,500 hours of full motion video and another 1,500 still images, much of it from Predators and Reapers on around-the-clock combat air patrols. Okay, that is a huge amount of data. Yeah. Now consider this micro aviary camouflage, this micro drone, these, you know, tiny little drones that are being developed and how much data they're going to be amassing. But before we talk about that, we should probably talk about just the micro aviary, drone, because it's pretty cool.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to get back to all of this. So hang in there 1 second.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
And we're back. We're talking about biomimicry, trying to make a drone that looks like a bird, flies like a bird, or flies like an insect,
yeah,
depending on, you know, which direction they're going there. But this is fascinating in that biomimicry is generally more involved in, I want to solve a problem,
mm-hmm,
like an engineering problem, mm-hmm, or design problem of some kind. Instead of trying to create some sort of, like, reinvent the wheel, I'm just going to look at the way nature has solved this problem through millions of years of evolution.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's stuff like, I want to make a swimsuit that allows the swimmer to move faster through the water. Instead of just trying to come up with something off the top of my head, I'm going to look at how shark skin has evolved.
Yeah, or
and mimic it.
Right, right. Or fins. I'm going to look at dolphins and see how they can actually, like, eject themselves into the
right
air and so on and so forth.
Yeah, we actually have a couple of articles on biomimicry on the website. If you go to howstuffworks.com and just throw biomimicry into the search bar, you'll find a couple of them. I think I may have written two of them or
you
one
probably
of them.
Did.
I don't know.
Yeah. Or a handful of them.
Yeah.
But from my understanding, they are focusing more on insects right now rather than birds. And I'm assuming that they've done birds so far because it's very hard to get, you know, smaller and smaller.
Right.
But birds are a little bit more difficult to mimic because of their musculature and because of the energy it takes
right
to get them
well
airborne.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about this, because most, like I say, biomimicry is about, I need to solve a problem, so I'm going to see how nature did it.
Right.
This is more about, I mean, in robotics, there's also a lot of interest in how insects move and behave, because sometimes it's a simple cognitive model, mm-hmm, to look at in terms of how it's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, like, you know, trying to create something that's going to move across the floor. Oftentimes, like a spider design just makes more sense,
yeah,
than trying to make it walk like a human. So, but in this, where they're trying to make a drone resemble, the animal form. And certainly when we're talking about something that flies, nature is kind of, forced to follow this winged model, this, mm-hmm, flapping winged model, which is really not that doesn't make a lot of sense from an energy standpoint. It's not, you have to spend a lot of energy to flap wings, but nature has not yet figured out how to evolve the rotor blade,
right.
So they're forced to flap. But we've all seen stats about, like, hummingbirds, about how much food they have to consume and how much energy they blow through to flap those tiny wings so fast.
Yeah, it's like 1,200 heartbeats per minute or something crazy. Like,
yeah, yeah. Like, some of them have to go into basically a state of hibernation, mm-hmm, every night, just because they can't burn any more energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not energy efficient.
Yeah, right.
So they're having to, when creating a flapping winged robot, you're having to pursue an energy inefficient design.
Right.
When you could really make a more energy efficient design.
Right, because they're not being inspired by it. They're actually trying to mimic it,
right,
so that nobody can tell that it's an actual robotic hummingbird who's,
yeah,
spying on you, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of a disingenuous form of biomimicry.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's the hummingbird drone that they unveiled. It's still a prototype, but it can rapidly beat its wings and it can propel at 11 miles per hour and even perch on a windowsill. The problem is, when you look at it, you know, if you glanced and didn't really, mm-hmm, look at it carefully, okay, yeah, I see a bird, right? But when you look at it, it actually looks really inelegant. It moves, you know, kind of awkwardly. It looks mechanical. It reminds me completely of Bebo the owl from Clash of the Titans.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
Yes.
The robotic owl that does the, yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah.
But I don't really think would make a great micro drone, right? Because it's very obvious.
Well, plus this hummingbird drone, it says U.S. Air Force on the wing. It's like, that's a dead giveaway.
Yeah. It's a little obvious. Yeah. But I mean, they're important because these micro drones could be used to get a much better view of a myriad things like natural disasters, floods, fires. You know, if the
sex lives of politicians.
Yes. Yeah. Wieners, wiener. They're used in aerial photography and they're even used in wildlife footage, which are seen in nature documentaries. So, and again, like, you know, if a building implodes and there's, you know, a lot of debris, these are things that we can use to get a better beat on things. It's not just, you know, used for warfare. So they're really interesting. And, it kind of makes me wonder, like, if one day we're all going to have our very own micro drone that we use, like, I don't know, in conjunction with an iPhone app,
yeah.
You know, so that we're on a zip line on vacation, you know, you just throw up your micro drone, get some really great footage.
Huh. Or you leave your micro drone behind to attend meetings when you go out of town. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah.
On the,
but anyway, I digress. We should probably get back to the actual
military use of
military
it.
Yeah. Applications of it.
Because
it, cool.
if you throw it into this overall design, this idea of like a robotic military, you can easily imagine like the micro drones sort of doing the first level scouting and surveillance, and then there's like a higher level of surveillance with larger flying vehicles, and then you have the attack UAVs that'll actually hit the target when needed, and then meanwhile like all the humans are back at their base.
And they're also, I wanted to mention this too, they're trying to increase the area that they can actually surveil. And right now they have what is called a soda straw view, you know, with the drones, but they're looking at a Gorgon stare technology. That's what they're calling it.
Gorgon stare?
Yeah. And again,
that's another great band title right now.
Well, and another Clash of the Titans reference, right?
Oh, Medusa. It is. Oh, because the idea is it's like a lot of little straws that are going to be like the snake heads on the Medusa.
I'm assuming so. That,
yeah,
or it's just
okay,
going to freeze
sense.
The landscape that it's looking at.
It seems like they would just want to, they must be really into Greek mythology or Clash of the Titans, because it seems like you just want to, you know, compare it to the eye structure of a fly.
Yeah, I don't know. Whoever is doing all the marketing for this really has a good beat on histrionics, I have to say. because, I mean, you know, the stealth drone that was used in Pakistan was called the Beast of Kandahar. I mean, that's, how can you not love that? But anyway, this Gorgon stare technology can capture live video of an entire city, but that requires 2,000 analysts to process the data feeds from a single drone compared with 19 analysts per drone today. That being said, this is something, technology that's going to be used pretty soon.
That's not much of a force multiplier, though, if that many people were required to sift through the data.
But, exactly.
But then again, it's, you couldn't actually send those people out to perch on somebody's shoulder in a war zone, or you know, in an enemy nation's capital or something.
That's the rub. We cannot shrink ourselves yet.
Yet.
But of course, what does this do? This is kind of freaking out some people. Why? Because this could be used for non-warfare applications. And in fact, there's a great Washington Post article called "Domestic Use of Aerial Drones by Law Enforcement Likely to Prompt Privacy Debate."
Ah.
And you know how this feeds into my whole privacy thing. By 2013, the FAA expects to have formulated new rules that would allow police across the country to routinely fly lightweight, unarmed drones up to 400 feet above ground, high enough for them to be largely invisible, eyes in the sky. And it's cost like $50,000, so it's really not that expensive. It's actually less than a police helicopter, so it's very likely that this is going to be used a lot in the future. But it can, the rub is that they can record the activities of public, below with high resolution infrared and thermal imaging cameras.
Huh. So you'll reach a point where someone, like, people will scatter. They're like, oh my goodness, there's a police pigeon flying. It's not, you know, it's not a real pigeon. It's mechanical.
Well, this, for this application, then it would be an actual, like, Cessna, like, drone.
Okay.
But, you know, obviously, this, it could become miniature, or it could become cost effective enough to get a micro drone. I mean, we're talking about 2013 that this is going to happen. Who knows, about 2020, 2030, 2040, micro drones might be in use all the time.
Right.
What does that mean? My bonfire when I'm playing Kumbaya on my guitar? They're going to be seeing that.
Huh.
Nobody needs to see that.
Now, the idea of like a totally automated military, like it fascinates me on multiple levels, but two things immediately come to mind. First of all, the Dark Crystal. Have you seen the Dark Crystal?
I've not seen the Dark Crystal. I feel like it comes up though, like every once in a while in our conversations, and I have to see it.
Well, it's a classic, but in this world of the Dark Crystal, you have the evil Skeksis who all kind of look like grotesque vultures in costume, and you know they're cowardly and they stick to their castle and they want to hunt down the Gelflings. That's their thing. And so they send out these crystals that are on bat wings, mm-hmm. that spy everywhere to try and find the Gelflings. And if they find the Gelflings, then they send out these giant beetle monstrosities that, shamble into the village to try and chop them to pieces, mm-hmm. or bring them back captive. And, so I would hate to see, like, you know, our nation follow the Skeksi model of military conquest to where, we're a bunch of, you know, disgusting vulture creatures who just send out our strange creations to get what we want from the surrounding world, because it becomes easier to do so. Suddenly you need more resources. Well, I don't have to actually fight a war. I just send off these robots to secure it for me. It becomes this, you know, kind of a robotic surgical colonialism. And then on the other hand, what happens when you have two opposing forces, each with a robot military? Does war ever end if two robot armies are fighting each other?
Well,
like it just becomes who runs out of parts first, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because right now the United States is certainly on the cutting edge of this.
Right, but everybody wants in on the game.
And they will. And in fact, the Danger Room on Wired talks about how China is actually really like a couple decades behind on this technology. And they will eventually catch up. But, I mean, for right now, you know, we're the big game changer on this.
Right.
But I mean, this is the whole thing. Like, we're game changers now, but 20, 30 years from now, how is it going to be used against us, or will it be used against us? And that's the danger whenever you introduce a new technology, right?
Yeah.
You're essentially introducing it against yourself at some point.
Well, I guess I just hope that if worse came to worse and like the robots of US and the robots of China were about to fight, mm-hmm. that Japan's Mecha Godzilla would jump in and just calm everybody down, like pulled up both of its claws and be like, all right, guys, settle it. Let's settle down.
Yeah, most certainly. And then hopefully their technology will have filtered down to us and we can all just pull over our vending machine cloaks, right? That they've developed. Well, they're not really cloaks, but you know what I'm talking
vending
about.
Vending machine cloaks.
I've told you about this before, right?
Where you look like a vending machine?
Right. It's disappear? Actually like this little zip-up thing that you erect. You know, it's portable. You can have it in your backpack. You whip it out. You set it up like a tent, and all of a sudden you look like a vending machine.
Well, that's good. Yeah. I like that use of our ingenuity rather than let's figure out better ways to blow each other up.
True. Yeah. But I will say a micro drone app would be pretty cool on a zip line.
Would it? Like instead of getting on the zip line, you would send
the
micro drone?
You get on the zip line, but then you have a micro drone who actually filming you while you're on the micro drone.
Oh, well, yes, that would be good.
And I should also mention too that Google CEO, I can't remember the name of this cat, but he purchased a micro drone for his own personal use, which freaked a bunch of people out because, of course, they thought that Google was going to start using, instead of Street View, you know, micro drones.
Huh. Well, I would be more concerned if, like, it seems like a better use of that for a large corporation would be corporate espionage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, if we see something flying around here that looks like Bebo, we will know corporate espionage is
going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So hopefully everybody knows to be a little more afraid of that unidentified bug or bird buzzing around outside the office now. So let's turn our attention to a little listener mail. All right. Eric writes in and says, just wanted to share a quickie with you. It's untrue that the platypus does not get respect. We respect the animal here in Oregon. The platypus trophy is awarded every year to the winner of the Civil War, the NCAA rivalry football game held between the saintly, beautiful, and awesome University of Oregon Ducks and the evil, ugly, vile Oregon State Beavers. Because the two team mascots are the Ducks and the Beavers, someone carved a beautiful wooden platypus that is now used as the trophy.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, that is pretty awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of, not really, but it's sort of thematically.
Amalgamation. Yeah. Nicely done. Thanks, Eric.
Yeah. So, Hey, if you guys want to share anything with us, you can, first of all, find us on Twitter and Facebook. We are Blow the Mind on both of those. And we populate both those feeds with all sorts of cool links and thoughts and you know, stuff about our upcoming episodes.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.